Zeer, not even looking at her. She's merely attempting a clever answer to an otherwise inane question. Honestly, Yim, this one has gotten pretty old.
Yim shrugged.
Fair enough. No further questions. Master Jiang?
All the masters twitched in irritation. From what Rin understood, Jiang was present only as a formality. He never gave an exam. He mostly just made fun of the students when they tripped over their answers. Jiang gazed levelly into Rin's eyes. She swallowed, feeling the unsettling sensation of his searching gaze. It was like she was as transparent as a puddle of rainwater.
"Who is imprisoned in the Chulu Kurik?"
he asked. She blinked. Not once in the 4 months that he had trained her had Jiang ever mentioned the Chulu Kurik. Neither had Master Yim or Irja, or even Jima. Chulu Kurik wasn't medical terminology, wasn't a reference to a famous battle, wasn't some linguistic term of art. It could be a deeply loaded phrase. It could also be gibberish. Either Jiang was posing a riddle, or he just wanted to throw her off. But she didn't want to admit defeat. She didn't want to look clueless in front of Irja. Jiang had asked her a question, and Jiang never asked questions during the trials. The masters were expecting an interesting answer now. She couldn't disappoint them. What was the cleverest way to say, "I don't know"? The Chulu Kurik. She'd studied Old Nikara with Jima for long enough now that she could gloss this as Stone Mountain in the ancient dialect, but that didn't give her any clues. None of Nikan's major prisons were built under mountains. They were either out in the Bagra Desert or in the dungeons of the Empress's palace. And Jiang hadn't asked what the Chulu Kurik was. He'd asked who was imprisoned there. What kind of prisoner couldn't be held in the Bagra Desert? She pondered this until she had an unsatisfying answer to an unsatisfying question. "Unnatural criminals," she said slowly. "Who have committed unnatural crimes?" June snorted audibly. Jima and Yim looked uncomfortable. Jiang gave a minuscule shrug.
"Fine," he said. "That's all I have."
Oral exams concluded by mid-morning on the third day. The pupils were sent to lunch, which no one ate, and then herded to the rings for the commencement of the tournament. Rin drew Han for her first opponent. When it was her turn to fight, she climbed down the rope ladder and looked up. The masters stood in a row before the rails. Irja gave her a slight nod, a tiny gesture that filled her with determination. June folded his arms over his chest. Jiang picked at his fingernails. Rin had not fought any of her classmates since her expulsion from combat. She had not even watched them fight. The only person she had ever sparred against was Jiang, and she had no clue if he was a good approximation of how her classmates might fight. She was entering this tournament blind. She squared her shoulders and took a deep breath, willing herself to at least appear calm. Han, on the other hand, looked very disconcerted. His eyes darted across her body and then back up to her face as if she were some wild animal he had never seen before, as if he didn't know quite what to make of her. "He's scared," she realized. He must have heard the rumors that she had studied with Jiang. He didn't know what to believe about her, didn't know what to expect. What was more, Rin was the underdog in this match. No one expected her to fight well. But Han had trained with June all year. Han was a Synegardian. Han had to win, or he wouldn't be able to face his peers after. Sun Tzu wrote that one must always identify and exploit the enemy's weaknesses. Han's weakness was psychological. The stakes were much, much higher for him, and that made him insecure. That made him beatable.
"You've never seen a girl before?" Rin asked.
Han blushed furiously. Good. She made him nervous. She grinned widely, baring teeth.
Lucky you, she said. You get to be my first.
You don't have a chance, Han blustered. You don't know any martial arts.
She merely smiled and slouched back into Sijin's fourth opening stance. She bent her back leg, preparing herself to spring, and raised her fists to guard her face.
Don't I?
Han's face clouded with doubt. He had recognized her posture as deliberate and practiced, not at all the stance of someone who had no martial arts training. Rin rushed him as soon as Sonnen signaled them to begin. Han played defensive from the start. He made the mistake of giving her the forward momentum, and he never recovered. From the outset, Rin controlled every part of the bout. She attacked. He reacted. She led him in the dance. She decided when to let him parry, and she decided where they would go. She fought methodically, purely from muscle memory. She was efficient. She played his moves against him and confused him. And Han's attacks fell into such predictable patterns. If one of his kicks missed, he would back up and attempt it again, and again, until she forced him to change direction. Finally, he let his guard down, let her get in close. She jammed her elbow hard into his nose. She felt a satisfying crack. Han dropped to the floor like a puppet whose strings had been cut. Rin knew she hadn't hurt him that badly. Zhang had punched her in the nose at least twice. Han was more stunned than injured. He could have gotten up. He didn't.
Break!
Ordered Sonnen. Rin wiped the sweat off her forehead and glanced up at the railing. There was silence above the ring. Her classmates looked like they had on the first day of class, startled and bewildered. Naja looked dumbfounded. Then Kit Tai began to clap. He was the only one. She fought two more matches that day. They were both variations on her match with Han. Pattern recognition, confusion, finishing blow. She won both of them. Over the span of a day, Rin went from the underdog to a leading contender. All those months spent lugging that stupid pig around had given her better endurance than her classmates. Those long, frustrating hours with the siege informs had given her impeccable footwork. The rest of the class had learned their fundamentals from Jun. They moved the same way, sank into the same default patterns when nervous. But Rin didn't. Her best advantage was her unpredictability. She fought like nothing they had been expecting. She threw them off rhythm. And so she continued to win. At the end of the first day, Rin and six others, including Neja and Benka, advanced undefeated into elimination rounds. Kitai had ended the first day with a 2-1 record but advanced on good technique. The quarterfinals were scheduled for the second day. Sonnen drew up a randomized bracket and hung it on a scroll outside the main hall for all to see. The pairings placed Rin against Venka first thing in the morning. Venka had trained in martial arts for years, and it showed. She was all rapid strikes and slick, impeccable footwork. She fought with a savage viciousness. Her technique was precise to the centimeter, her timing perfect. She was just as fast as Rin. Perhaps faster. The one advantage Rin had was that Venka had never fought with an injury.
She sparred plenty of times, said Kit Tai, but nobody is actually willing to hit her. Everyone's always stopped before the punch lands. Even Naja. I'll bet you none of her home tutors were willing to hit her either. They would have been fired immediately, if not thrown in jail.
You're kidding, Rin said.
I know I've never hit her.
Rin rubbed a fist into her palm.
Maybe it'll be good for her then.
Still, injuring Venka was no easy task. More by sheer luck than anything, Rin managed to land a blow early on in the match. Venka, underestimating Rin's speed, had brought her guard back up too slowly after an attempted left hook. Rin took the opening and whipped a backhand through at Venka's nose. Bone broke under Rin's fist with an audible crack. Venka immediately retreated. One hand flew to her face, groping around her swelling nose.
She glanced down at her blood-covered fingers and then back up at Rin. Her nostrils flared. Her cheeks turned a ghastly white.
Problem?
Rin asked. The look Venka gave her was pure murder.
You shouldn't even be here, she snarled.
Tell that to your nose, Rin said.
Venka was visibly unhinged. Her pretty sneer was gone, her hair messy, her face bloodied, her eyes wild and unfocused. She was on edge, off rhythm. She attempted several more wild blows until Rin caught her with a solid roundhouse kick to the side of her head. Venka sprawled to the side and stayed on the ground. Her chest heaved rapidly up and down. Rin couldn't tell if she was crying or panting. She didn't really care. The applause as Rin emerged from the ring was scattered at best. The audience had been rooting for Venka. Venka was supposed to be in the finals. Rin didn't care about that either. She was used to this by now. And Venka wasn't the victory she wanted. Najad tore his way through the other side of the bracket with ruthless efficiency. His fights were always scheduled in the other ring concurrently with Rin's, and they invariably ended earlier. Rin never saw Najad in action. She only saw his opponents carried out on stretchers. Alone among Najad's opponents, Kitai emerged from his bout unharmed. He had lasted a minute and a half before surrendering. There were rumors Najad would be disqualified for intentional maiming, but Rin knew better than to hope. The faculty wanted to see the heir to the House of Yin in the finals. As far as Rin knew, Najad could kill someone without repercussion. Jun certainly would allow it. No one was surprised when Rin and Najad both won their semi-finals rounds. Finals were postponed until after dinner so that the apprentices could also come and watch. Najad disappeared somewhere halfway through dinner. He was likely getting private coaching from Jun. Rin briefly considered reporting it to get Najad disqualified, but knew that would be a hollow victory. She wanted to see this through to the finish. She picked at her food. She knew she needed energy, but the thought of eating made her want to vomit. Halfway through the break, Raban approached her table. He was sweating hard, as if he had just run all the way up from the lower tier. She thought he was going to congratulate her on making it to finals, but all he said was, "You should surrender."
"You're joking," Rin responded. "I'm going to win this thing."
"Look, Rin, you haven't seen any of Najah's fights."
"I've been a little preoccupied with my own."
"Then you don't know what he's capable of. I just dealt with his semi-finals opponent in the infirmary. Nohai."
Raban looked deeply rattled.
"They're not sure if he's going to be able to walk again. Najah shattered his kneecap."
"Seems like Nohai's problem."
Rin didn't want to hear about Najah's victories. She was feeling queasy enough as it was. The only way she could go through with the finals was if she convinced herself that Najah was beatable.
"I know he hates you," Raban continued. "He could cripple you for life."
"He's just a kid,"
Rin scoffed with a confidence she didn't feel.
"You're just a kid,"
Raban sounded agitated.
"I don't care how good you think you are. Najah's got 6 inches and 20 pounds of muscle on you, and I swear he wants to kill you."
"He has weaknesses," she said stubbornly.
That had to be true, didn't it?
"Does it matter? What does this tournament mean to you anyway?"
Raban asked.
"There's no way you're getting called now. Every master is going to submit a bid for you. Why do you have to win?"
Raban was right. At this point, Irja would have no qualms about bidding for her. Rin's position at Sinigard was safe. But it wasn't about bids now. It was about pride. It was about power. If she surrendered to Najah, he would hold it over her for the rest of their time at the academy. No, he'd hold it over her for life.
"Because I can," she said. "Because he thought he could get rid of me. Because I want to break his stupid face."
The basement hall was silent as Rin and Najah climbed into the ring. The air was thick with anticipation, a voyeuristic bloodlust. Months of hateful rivalry were coming to a head, and everyone wanted to watch the fallout of their collision. Both Jun and Irja wore deliberately neutral expressions, giving nothing away. Jiang was absent. Najah and Rin bowed shortly, never taking their eyes off each other, and both immediately backed away. Najah kept his gaze trained intently on Rin's, almond eyes narrowed in a tight focus. His lips were pressed in concentration. There were no jeers, no taunts, not even a snarl. Najah was taking her seriously, Rin realized. He took her as an equal. For some reason, this made her fiercely proud. They stared at each other, daring each other to break eye contact first.
"Begin,"
said Sonnen. She leaped at him immediately. Her right leg lashed out again and again, forcing him back in retreat. Kitai had spent all of lunch helping her strategize. She knew Najah could be blindingly fast. Once he got momentum, he wouldn't stop until his opponent was incapacitated or dead. Rin needed to overwhelm him from the beginning. She needed to constantly put him on the defensive, because to be on the defensive against Najah was certain defeat. The problem was that he was terribly strong. He didn't possess the brute force of Kobin, or even Kareel, but he was so precise in his movements that it didn't matter. He channeled his ki with a brilliant precision, built it up and then released it through the smallest pressure point to create the maximum impact. Unlike Venka, Najah could absorb losses and continue. She bruised him once or twice. He adapted and hit her back. And his blows hurt. They were 2 minutes in. Rin had now lasted longer than any of Najah's previous opponents, and something had become clear to her. He wasn't invincible. The techniques that had seemed impossibly difficult to her before now were transparently beatable. When Najah kicked, his movements were wide and obvious like a boar's. His kicks held terrifying power, but only if they landed. Rin made sure they never landed. There was no way she would let him maim her. But she was not here merely to survive. She was here to win. Exploding dragon. Crouching tiger. Extended crane. She cycled through the movements in Sijin's frolics as they were needed. The movements she'd practiced so many times before, linked together one after another in that damned form, snapped automatically into play. But if Najah was baffled by Rin's fighting style, he didn't show it. He remained calm and concentrated, attacking with methodical efficiency. They were now 4 minutes in. Rin felt her lungs seizing, trying to pump oxygen into her fatigued body. But she knew that if she was tired, so was Najah.
"He gets desperate when he's tired," Kitai had said. "And he's the most dangerous when he's desperate."
Najah was getting desperate. There was no control to his ki anymore. He threw punch after punch in her direction. He didn't care about the maiming rule. If he got her on the ground, he would kill her. Najah swept a low kick at the back of her knees. Rin made a frantic call and let him connect, sinking backward, pretending she'd lost her balance. He moved in immediately, looming over her. She grounded herself against the floor and kicked up. She nailed him directly in his solar plexus with more force than she'd ever kicked with before. She could feel the air forced out of his lungs. She flipped up off the ground and was astonished to find Najah still reeling backward, gasping for air. She flung herself forward and punched wildly at his head. He dropped to the floor. Shocked murmurs swept through the audience. Rin circled Najah, hoping he wouldn't get up, but knowing he would. She wanted to end it. Slam her heel into the back of his head. But the masters cared about honor. If she hit Najah while he was down, she'd be sent packing from Sinigard in minutes. never mind that if he did the same, she doubted anyone would bat an eye. 4 seconds passed. Nadja raised a shaking hand and slammed it into the ground. He dragged himself forward. His forehead was bleeding, dripping scarlet into his eyes. He blinked it away and glared up at her. His eyes screamed murder.
"Continue," said Sonnen.
Rin circled Nadja warily. He crouched like an animal, like a wounded wolf rising on its haunches. The next time she threw a punch, he grabbed her arm and pulled her in close. Her breath hitched. He raked his nails across her face and down to her collarbone. She jerked her arm out of his grasp and cycled backward in rapid retreat. She felt a sharp sting under her left eye, across her neck. Nadja had drawn blood.
"Watch yourself, Yin,"
Sonnen warned. Both of them ignored him. Like a warning would make any difference, Rin thought. The next time Nadja lunged at her, she pulled him to the floor with her. They rolled around in the dirt, each attempting to pin the other and failing. He punched madly in the air, flinging blows haphazardly at her face. She dodged the first one. He swung his fist back in reverse and caught her with a backhand that left her gasping. The lower half of her face went numb. He'd slapped her. He'd slapped her! A kick she could take. A knife hand strike she could absorb. But that slap had a savage intimacy. An undertone of superiority. Something in Rin broke. She couldn't breathe. Black tinged the edges of her vision. Black, and then scarlet. An awful rage filled her, consumed her thoughts entirely. She needed revenge like she needed to breathe. She wanted Nadja to hurt. She wanted Nadja punished. She lashed back, fingers curled into claws. He let go of her to jump back, but she followed him, redoubling her frenzied attacks. She wasn't as fast as he was. He retaliated, and she was too slow to block, and he hit her on the thigh, on the arm. But her body wouldn't register the damage. Pain was a message she was ignoring, to be felt later. No. Pain led to success. He struck her face once, twice, thrice. He beat her like an animal, and yet she kept fighting.
"What is wrong with you?"
he hissed. More important was what was wrong with him. Fear. She could see it in his eyes. He had her backed against the wall, hands around her neck, but she grabbed his shoulders, jammed her knee up into his rib cage, and rammed an elbow into the back of his head. He collapsed forward to the ground, wheezing. She flung herself down and ground her elbow into his lower back. Nadja cried out, arched his back in agony. Rin pinned Naja's left arm to the floor with her foot and held his neck down with her right elbow. When he struggled, she slammed her fist into the back of his head and ground his face against the dirt until it was clear that he wouldn't get up.
"Break!"
said Sonnen. But she barely heard him. Blood thundered in her ears to a rhythm like war drums. Her vision was filtered through a red lens that registered only enemy targets. She grasped a handful of Naja's hair in her hand and yanked his head up again to slam into the floor.
"Break!"
Sonnen's arms were around her neck, restraining her, dragging her off Nadja's limp form. She staggered away from Sonnen. Her body was burning up, feverish. She reeled, suddenly dizzy. She felt full to bursting with heat. She had to dispel it, force it out somewhere, or she'd surely die. But the only place to put it was in the bodies of everyone else around her. Something deep inside her rational mind screamed. Raban reached for her as she climbed up out of the ring.
"Rin, what?"
She shoved his hand away. "Move!" she panted. "Move!" But the masters crowded around her, a hubbub of voices, hands reaching, mouths moving. Their presence was suffocating. She felt if she screamed, she could disintegrate them entirely. Wanted to disintegrate them. But the very small part of her that was still rational reined it in, sent her reeling for the exit instead. Miraculously, they cleared a path for her. She pushed her way through the crowd of apprentices and ran to the stairwell. She barreled up the stairs, burst out the door of the main hall into the cold, open air, and sucked in a great breath. It wasn't enough. She was still burning. Ignoring the shouts of the masters behind her, she set off at a run. Zhang was in the first place she looked, the lower garden. He was sitting cross-legged, eyes closed, still as the stone he sat upon. She lurched through the garden gates, gripping at the doorpost. The world swirled sideways. Everything looked red. The trees, the stones, Zhang most of all. He flared in front of her like a torch. He opened his eyes to the sound of her crashing through the gate. Rin? She had forgotten how to speak. The flames within her licked out toward Zhang, sensed his presence like a fire sensed kindling and yearned to consume him. She became convinced that if she didn't kill him, she might explode. She moved to attack him. He scrambled to his feet, dodged her outstretched hands, and then upended her with a deft throw. She landed on her back. He pinned her to the ground with his arms. "You're burning," he said in amazement.
"Help me,"
she gasped.
"Help!"
He leaned forward and cupped her head in his hands.
"Look at me."
She obeyed with great difficulty. His face swam before her.
"Great tortoise,"
he murmured, and let go of her. His eyes rolled up in the back of his head and he began uttering indecipherable noises, syllables that didn't resemble any language she knew. He opened his eyes and pressed the palm of his hand to her forehead. His hand felt like ice. The searing cold flooded from his palm to her forehead and into the rest of her body, through the same rivulets the flame was coursing through, arresting the fire, stilling it in her veins. She felt as if she'd been doused in a freezing bath. She writhed on the floor, breathing in shock, trembling as the fire left her blood. Then everything was still. Jiang's face was the first thing she saw when she regained consciousness. His clothes looked rumpled. There were deep circles under his eyes, as if he hadn't slept in days. How long had she been asleep? Had he been here the entire time? She raised her head. She was lying in a bunk in the infirmary, but she wasn't injured, as far as she could tell.
"How do you feel?"
Zhang asked quietly. "Bruised, but okay." She sat up slowly and winced. Her mouth felt like it was filled with cotton. She coughed and rubbed at her throat, frowning.
"What happened?"
Zhang offered her a cup of water that had been sitting beside her bunk. She took it gratefully. The water sluiced down her dry throat with the most wonderful sensation.
"Congratulations," Zhang said. "You're this year's champion."
His tone did not sound congratulatory at all. Rin felt none of the exhilaration that she should have anyway. She couldn't even relish her victory over Nedja. She didn't feel the least bit proud. Just scared and confused.
"What did I do?" she whispered.
"You have stumbled upon something that you're not ready for," said Jiang.
He sounded agitated.
"I never should have taught you the five frolics. From this point forward, you're just going to be a danger to yourself and everyone around you."
"Not if you help me," she said. "Not if you teach me otherwise."
"I thought you just wanted to be a good soldier."
"I do," she said.
But more than that, she wanted power. She had no idea what had happened in the ring. She would be foolish not to feel terrified by it. And yet, she had never felt power like it. In that instant, she had felt as if she could defeat anyone. Kill anything. She wanted that power again. She wanted what Jung could teach her. I was ungrateful that day in the garden, she said, choosing her words carefully. If she spoke too obsequiously, then it would scare Jung off.
But if she didn't apologize, then Jung might think that she hadn't learned anything since they'd last spoken.
I wasn't thinking. I apologize. She watched his eyes apprehensively, looking for that telltale, distant expression that indicated that she had lost him. Jung's features did not soften, but neither did he get up to leave.
No, it was my fault. I didn't realize how much like Alton you are.
Rin jerked her head up at the mention of Alton.
He won in his year, you know,
Jung said flatly.
He fought Toby in the finals. It was a grudge match, just like your match with Naja. Alton hated Toby. Toby made some jabs about Spear their first week of school, and Alton never forgave him. But he wasn't like you. He didn't squabble with Toby throughout the year like a pecking hen. Alton swallowed his anger and concealed it under a mask of indifference, until, at the very end, in front of an audience that included 6 warlords and the Empress herself, he unleashed a power so potent that it took Sonnen, June, and myself to restrain him. By the time the smoke cleared, Toby was so badly injured that Enro didn't sleep for 5 days while she watched over him.
I'm not like that, she said. She hadn't beaten Naja that badly. Had she? It was hard to remember through that fog of anger. I'm not like Alton.
You are precisely the same.
Jung shook his head.
You're too reckless. You hold grudges. You cultivate your rage and let it explode. And you're careless about what you're taught. Training you would be a mistake.
Rin's gut plummeted. She was suddenly afraid that she might go mad. She had been given a tantalizing taste of incredible power. But was this the end of the road? So that's why you withdrew your bid for Alton? She asked. Why you refused to teach him? Jung looked puzzled.
I didn't withdraw my bid, he said. I insisted they put him under my watch. Alton was a Spearly, already predisposed to rage and disaster. I knew I was the only one who could help him.
But the apprentices said—
The apprentices don't know shit, Jung snapped. I asked Jima to let me train him, but the Empress intervened. She knew the military value of a Spearly warrior. She was so excited. In the end, national interests superseded the sanity of one boy. They put him under Irja's tutelage and honed his rage like a weapon, instead of teaching him to control it. You've seen him in the ring. You know what he's like.
Jung leaned forward.
But you... The Empress doesn't know about you.
He muttered to himself more than he spoke to her.
You're not safe, but you will be. They won't intervene. Not this time.
She watched Jung's face, not daring to hope. So does that mean... He stood up.
I will take you on as an apprentice. I hope I will not come to regret it.
He extended a hand toward her. She reached up and grasped it. Of the original 50 students who matriculated at Synegard at the start of the term, 35 received bids for apprenticeship. The masters sent their scrolls to the office in the main hall to be picked up by the students. Those students who received no scrolls were asked to hand in their uniforms and make arrangements to leave the academy immediately. Most students received one scroll only. Nyang, to her delight, joined 2 other students in the medicine track. Naja and Venka pledged combat. Kitai, convinced he'd lost his bids the moment he surrendered to Naja, tugged at his hair so frantically the entire way to the front office that Rin was half afraid he'd go bald.
It was a stupid thing, Kitai said. Cowardly! No one surrendered uninjured in the last 2 decades! Nobody's going to want to sponsor me now!
Up until the tournament, he'd been expecting bids from Jima, June, and Irja. But only one scroll was waiting for him at the registrar. Kitai unfurled it. His face split into a grin.
Yurja thinks surrendering was brilliant. I'm pledging strategy!
The registrar handed two scrolls to Rin. Without opening them, she knew they were from Yurja and Jiang. She could choose between strategy and lore. She pledged lore.
Chapter 8 Synegard Academy gave students 4 days off from studies to celebrate the summer festival. The next term would begin as soon as they returned. Most students took this as a chance to visit their families, but Rin didn't have time to travel all the way back to Takani, nor did she want to. She had planned on spending the break at the academy, until Kitai invited her to stay at his estate.
"Unless you don't want to," Kitai said nervously. "I mean, if you already have plans..."
"I have no plans," Rin said. "I'd love to."
She packed for her excursion into the city the next morning. This took mere seconds. She had very few personal belongings. She carefully folded 2 sets of school tunics into her old travel satchel, and hoped Kitai would not find it rude if she wore her uniform during the festival. She had no other clothing. She'd gotten rid of her old southerner's tunics the first chance she got.
"I'll get a rickshaw," Rin offered as she met Kitai at the school gates.
Kitai looked puzzled.
"Why do we need a rickshaw?"
Rin frowned.
"Then how are we getting there?"
Kitai opened his mouth to reply just as a massive horse-drawn carriage pulled up by the gates. The driver, a portly man in robes of rich gold and burgundy, hopped off the coachman's seat and bowed deeply in Kitai's direction.
"Master Chen."
He blinked at Rin, as if trying to decide whether to bow to her as well, and then managed a perfunctory head dip.
"Thanks, Merchi."
Kitai handed their bags to the servant and helped Rin into the carriage.
"Comfortable?"
"Very."
From their vantage point in the carriage, they could see almost all the city nested in the valley below, the spiraling pagodas of the administrative district rising through a faint blanket of mist, white houses built into the valley slopes with curved tiled roofs, and the winding stone walls of the alleyways leading downtown. From the shaded interior of the carriage, Rin felt insulated from the dirty city streets. She felt clean. For the first time since she had arrived in Synegard, she felt as if she belonged here. She leaned against the side and enjoyed the warm summer breeze against her face. She had not rested like this in a long time.
"We will discuss what happened to you in detail when you return,"
Jiang had told her.
"But your mind has just suffered a very particular trauma. The best thing you can do for yourself now is rest. Let the experience germinate. Let your mind heal."
Kitai, tactfully, did not ask her what had happened. Rin was grateful for it. Merchi drove them at a brisk pace down the mountain pass. They continued on the main city road for an hour, and then turned left onto the isolated road that led into the Jade District. When Rin had arrived in Synegard a year ago, she and Tutor Feyrick had traveled through the working-class district, where the inns were cheap and gambling houses stood around every corner. Her daily trips to see the Widow Meng had led her through the loudest, dirtiest, and smelliest parts of the city. What she'd seen of Synegard so far was no different from Takani. It was just noisier and more cramped. Now, riding in the Chen family's carriage, she saw how splendid Synegard could be. The roads of the Jade District were freshly paved and glistened like they had been scrubbed clean that very morning. Rin saw no wooden shacks, no evident dumping grounds for chamber pots. She saw no grumpy housewives steaming breads and dumplings on outdoor grills, too poor to afford indoor stoves. She saw no beggars. She found the stillness unsettling. Takani was always bustling with activity, drifters collecting trash to repackage and sell, old men sitting on stoops outside, smoking or playing mahjong, little children wearing jumpers that exposed their butt cheeks, wandering around the streets followed by squatting grandparents ready to catch them when they toppled over. she saw none of that here. The Jade District was composed of pristine barriers and walled-off gardens. Aside from their carriage, the roads were empty. Merchi stopped the carriage before the gates of a massive compound. They swung ponderously open, revealing four long rectangular buildings arranged in a square, enclosing an enormous garden pavilion. Several dogs rushed them at the entrance, tiny white things whose paws were as immaculately clean as the tiled path they walked on. Kitai gave a shout, climbed out of the carriage, and knelt down. His dogs leaped on him, tails wagging with delirious delight.
"This one's the Dragon Emperor,"
he tickled a dog under its chin.
"They're all named after the great rulers."
"Which one's the Red Emperor?" Ren asked.
"The one that's going to pee on your foot if you don't move."
The estate's housekeeper was a short, plump woman with freckled, leathery skin named Lan. She spoke with a friendly, girlish voice that was at odds with her wrinkled face. Her Synegardian accent was so strong that even after several months' practice with the heavily accented Widow Mong, Rin still could only barely decipher it.
"What do you want to eat? I'll cook you anything you want. I know the culinary styles of all 12 provinces, except the Monkey Province. Too spicy. It's not good for you. I also don't do stinky tofu. My only constraint is what's on the market, but I can get just about anything at the import store. Any favorite recipes? Lobster or water chestnuts? You name it, I'll cook it."
Rin, who was accustomed to eating the uninspired slop of the academy canteen, was at a loss for a response. How was she to explain she simply didn't have the repertoire of meals that Lan demanded? Back in Takani, the Fongs were fond of a dish named Whatever, which was quite literally made of whatever scraps were left at the shop, usually fried eggs and glass noodles.
"I want 7 treasure soup,"
Kitai intervened, leaving Rin to wonder what on earth that was.
"And lion's head."
Rin blinked.
"What?"
Kitai looked amused.
"Oh, you'll see. You could act less like a dazed peasant, you know,"
Kitai said as Lan laid out a spread of quail eggs, shark fin soup served in turtle shell, and pig's intestines before them.
"It's just food."
But just food was rice porridge. Maybe some vegetables. A piece of fish, pork, or chicken whenever they could get it. Nothing on the table was just anything. 7 treasure soup turned out to be a deliciously sweet, congee-based concoction of red dates, honeyed chestnuts, lotus seeds, and 4 other ingredients that Rin could not identify. Lion's head, she discovered with some relief, was not actually a lion's head, but rather a ball of meat mixed with flour and boiled amid strips of white tofu.
"Kitai, I am a dazed peasant."
Rin tried fruitlessly to pick up a quail egg with her chopsticks. Finally, she gave up and used her fingers.
"You eat like this? All the time?"
Kitai blushed.
"You get used to it. I had a hard time our first week at school. The academy canteen was awful."
It was hard not to feel jealous of Kitai. His private washroom was bigger than the cramped bedroom Rin had shared with Kisagi. His estate's library rivaled the stacks at Synegard. Everything Kitai owned was replaceable. If he got mud on his shoes, he threw them away. If his shirt ripped, he got a new one, a newly made shirt, tailored to his precise height and girth. Kitai had spent his childhood in luxurious comfort, with nothing better to do than study for the Kaju. For him, testing into Synegard had been a pleasant surprise, a confirmation of something he'd always known was his destiny.
"Where's your father?" Rin asked.
Kitai's father was the defense minister to the Empress herself. She was privately relieved she wouldn't have to converse with him yet. The thought itself was terrifying, but she couldn't help feeling curious about the man. Would he be an older version of Kitai? Wiry-haired, just as brilliant, and exponentially more powerful? Kitai made a face.
"Defense meetings. You wouldn't know it, but the whole city is on high security alert. The entire city guard will be on duty all this week. We don't need another opera incident."
"I thought the Red Junk Opera was dead," said Rin.
"Mostly dead. You can't kill a movement. Somewhere out there, some religious lunatics are intent on killing the Empress.
Kitai speared a chunk of tofu.
Father's going to be at the palace until the parade is over. He's directly responsible for the Empress's safety. If anything goes wrong, Father's head is on the line.
Isn't he worried?
Not really. He's done this for decades. He'll be all right. Besides, the Empress is a martial artist herself. She's hardly an easy target.
Kitai launched into a series of anecdotes his father had told him about serving in the palace, about hilarious encounters with the Empress and the 12 warlords, about court gossip and provincial politics. Rin listened in amazement. What was it like to grow up knowing that your father served at the right hand of the Empress? What a difference an accident of birth made. In another world, she might have grown up at an estate like this, with all of her desires within reach. In another world, she might have been born into power. Rin spent the night in a massive suite she had all to herself. She hadn't slept so long or so well since she came to Synegard. It was as if her body had shut down after weeks of abuse. She awoke feeling better and clearer-minded than she had in months. After a lackadaisical breakfast of sweet congee and spiced goose eggs, Kitai and Rin wandered downtown to the marketplace. Rin hadn't set foot downtown since arriving to Synegard with Tutor Feyrik a year prior. The Widow Mong lived on the other side of the city, and her strict academic schedule had left her with no time to explore Synegard on her own. She had thought the market was overwhelming last year. Now, at peak activity during the summer festival, it seemed like the city had exploded. Pop-up vendor carts were parked everywhere, crammed into the alleyways so tightly that shoppers had to navigate the market in a cramped, single-file line. But the sights! Oh, the sights! Rin saw rows upon rows of pearl necklaces and jade bracelets, stands of smooth, egg-sized rocks that displayed characters, sometimes entire poems, only if you dipped them in water. Stations where calligraphy masters wrote names on giant, lovely fans, wielding their black ink brushes with the care and bravado of swordsmen.
What do these do?
Rin stopped in front of a rack bearing tiny wooden statues of fat little boys. The boys' tunics were yanked down, exposing their penises.
She couldn't believe anything this obscene was on sale. Oh, those are my favorite,
Kitai said. By way of explanation, the vendor picked up a teapot and poured water over the statues. The clay darkened as the statues turned wet. Water began spurting out of the penises like sprays of urine. Rin laughed.
How much are these? 4 silvers for one. I'll give you 2 for 7.
Rin blanched. All she had was a single string of imperial silvers and a handful of copper coins left over from the money Tutor Feyrik had helped her exchange. She had never had to spend money at the academy, and hadn't considered how expensive things might be in Synegard when she wasn't living on the academy's coin.
Do you want it?
Kitai asked. Rin waved her hands wildly.
No, I'm good. I can't really.
Understanding dawned on Kitai's face.
My gift.
He handed a string of silvers to the merchant.
1 urinating statue for my easily entertained friend.
Rin blushed.
Kitai, I can't.
It costs nothing.
It costs a lot to me, she said.
Kitai placed the statue in her hand.
If you say one more thing about money, I'm leaving you to get lost.
The market was so massive that Rin was reluctant to stray too far from the entrance. If she became lost in those winding pathways, how would she ever find her way out? But Kitai navigated the market with the ease of a seasoned connoisseur, pointing out which shops he liked and which he didn't. Kitai's Synegard was full of wonders, completely accessible, and crammed with things that belonged to him. Kitai's Synegard wasn't terrifying, because Kitai had money. If he tripped, half the shop owners on the street would help him up, hoping for a handsome tip. If his pocket were cut, he'd go home and get another purse. Kitai could afford to be victimized by the city because he had room to fail. Rin couldn't. She had to remind herself that, despite Kitai's absurd generosity, none of this was hers. Her only ticket into the city was through the academy, and she'd have to work hard to keep it. At night, the marketplace lit up with lanterns, one for each vendor. Together, the lanterns looked like a horde of fireflies, casting unnatural shadows on everything their light touched.
"Have you ever seen shadow puppetry?"
Kitai stopped in front of a large canvas tent. A line of children stood at the entrance, doling out copper shells for entrance.
"I mean, it's for little kids, but..."
"Great tortoise!"
Rin's eyes widened. In Takani, they told stories about shadow puppetry. She fished the change out of her pocket.
"I got this."
The tent was packed with rows of children. Kitai and Rin filed into the back, trying to pretend they weren't at least 5 years older than the rest of the audience. At the front, a massive silk screen hung from the top of the tent, illuminated from behind with soft yellow light.
"I tell you now about the rebirth of this nation."
The puppeteer spoke from a box beside the screen, so that even his silhouette was invisible. His voice filled the cramped tent, deep and smooth and resonant.
"This is the tale of the salvation and reunion of Nikon. This is the story of the trifecta, the three warriors of legend."
The light behind the screen dimmed, and then flared a bright scarlet hue.
"The warrior."
The first shadow appeared on the screen, the silhouette of a man with a massive sword almost as tall as he was. He was heavily armored, with spiked pads protruding out from his shoulders. The plume on his helmet furled into the air above him.
"The Vipress."
The slender form of a woman appeared next to the warrior. Her head tilted coquettishly to one side, her left arm bent as if she wielded something behind her back. A fan, perhaps. Or a dagger.
"And the gatekeeper."
The gatekeeper was the thinnest of the three, a stooped figure wrapped in robes. By his side crawled a large tortoise. The scarlet hue of the screen faded away to a soft yellow that pulsed slowly like a heartbeat. The shadows of the trifecta grew larger and then disappeared. A silhouette of a mountainous land appeared in their place, and the puppeteer began his story in earnest.
65 years ago, in the wake of the First Poppy War, the people of Nikon suffered under the weight of their Federation oppressors. Nikon lay sick, feverish under the clouds of the poppy drug.
Translucent ribbons drifted up from the profile of the countryside, giving the illusion of smoke.
The people starved. Mothers sold their infants for a pound of meat, for a bolt of cloth. Fathers killed their children rather than watch them suffer. Yes, that's right. Children just like you. The Nakara thought the gods had abandoned them. For how else could the barbarians from the east have wreaked such destruction upon them?
The screen turned the same sickly yellow pallor as the cheeks of poppy addicts. A line of Nakata peasants knelt with their heads bent to the floor, as if weeping.
The people found no protection in the warlords. The rulers of the 12 provinces, once powerful, were now weak and disorganized. Preoccupied with ancient grudges, they wasted time and soldiers fighting against each other, rather than uniting to drive out the invaders from Mugen. They squandered gold on drink and women. They breathed the poppy drug like air. They taxed their provinces at exorbitant rates and gave nothing back. Even when the Federation destroyed their villages and raped their women, the warlords did nothing. They could do nothing. The people prayed for heroes. They prayed for 20 years. And finally, the gods sent them.
A silhouette of three children, hand in hand, appeared on the lower left corner of the screen. The child in the center stood taller than the rest. The one on his right had long, flowing hair. The third child, standing a little removed from the other two, had his profile turned away toward the end of the screen, as if he was looking at something the other two could not see.
The gods did not send these heroes from the skies. Rather, they chose three children. War orphans. Peasants whose parents had been killed in village raids. They were born of the humblest origins. But they were meant to walk with the gods.
The child in the center strode purposefully to the middle of the screen. The other two followed him at a distance, like he was their leader. The limbs of the shadows moved so smoothly there might have been little men in costume behind the screen, not puppets made of paper and string. Rin marveled at the technique involved, even as she was further absorbed into the story.
When their village burned, the three children formed a pact to seek revenge against the Federation and liberate their country from the invaders, so that no more children would suffer as they had. They trained for many years with the monks of the Wudang Temple. By the time they matured, their martial arts skills were prodigious, and they rivaled in skill fully grown men who had been training for decades. At the end of their apprenticeship, they journeyed to the top of the highest peak in all of the land, Mount Tian Shan.
A massive mountain came into view. It took up almost the entire screen. The shadows of the three heroes were minuscule beside it. But as they walked toward the mountain, the peak grew smaller and smaller, flatter and flatter, until the heroes stood on flat ground at the very top.
There are 7,000 steps that lead up to the peak of Mount Tian Shan. And at the very top, far up so high that the strongest eagle could not circle the peak, lies a temple. From that temple, the three heroes walked into the heavens and entered the Pantheon, the home of the gods.
The three heroes now approached a gate similar to those that guarded the entrance to the academy. The doors were twice the hero's height, decorated with intricately curling patterns of butterflies and tigers, and guarded by a great tortoise that bowed its head low as it let them pass.
The first hero, strongest among his companions, was summoned by the Dragon Lord. The hero stood a head taller than his friends. His back was broad, his arms like tree trunks. He had been deemed by the gods to be the leader of the three. "If I am to command the armies of Nikon, I must have a great blade," he said, and knelt at the feet of the Dragon Lord. The Dragon Lord bade him stand, and bestowed upon him a massive sword. Thus he became the warrior.
The warrior's figure swung the huge sword in a great arc above his head and brought it smashing downward. Sparks of red and gold light emitted from the ground where the sword struck.
The second hero was a girl among the two men. She walked past the Dragon Lord, the Tiger Lord, and the Lion Lord, for they were gods of war and therefore gods of men. She said, "I am a woman, and women need different weapons than men. The woman's place is not in the thick of battle. The woman's battlefield is in deception and seduction." And she knelt before the plinth of the snail goddess Nuwa. The goddess Nuwa was pleased by her words, and made the second hero as deadly as a serpent, as bewitching as the most hypnotic of snakes. Thus was born the Vipress.
A great serpent slithered out from under the Vipress's dress and undulated about her body, coiling upward to rest on her shoulders. The audience applauded the graceful trick of puppetry.
The third hero was the humblest among his peers. Weak and sickly, he had never been able to train to the extent of his two friends. But he was loyal and unswerving in his devotion to the gods. He did not beg a favor from any deity in the Pantheon, for he knew he was not worthy. Instead, he knelt before the humble tortoise who had let them in. I ask only for the strength to protect my friends and the courage to protect my country, he said. The tortoise replied, You will be given this and more.